Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. When you're a teenager, everybody tells you that getting pregnant can happen so fast, you won't even know what hit you.
Don't have sex, because you will get pregnant. Don't have sex in the missionary position. Don't have sex standing up. Just don't do it, promise?
But then when you're older, maybe you're trying to have a baby, and you look at this process more closely, you realize it's really complicated.
There are so many things that have to happen in order for a pregnancy to occur.
That's OBGYN Fairness Farhi.
I think of it as a sort of synchronized dance with a lot of team members, all of whom are dependent on one another. So if there's one member or one hormone that isn't functioning in the way that it needs to, it can throw off the entire process.
An egg is released just once a month, and it's only viable for up to 24 hours. So the sperm has to meet the egg during that time. And then once the egg is fertilized, the dance continues, right? The synchronized dance of hormones and conditions.
Absolutely. So once the sperm and egg meet to form a pregnancy, this usually happens in a tube. The fertilized egg then has to travel to the uterus. And so this requires also a normally functioning tube. The pregnancy then has to make its home or implant in the right part of the uterus. And if the pregnancy doesn't implant in the right part of the uterus, it won't be able to grow and develop.
When this process doesn't work out for people naturally, it can be really difficult to determine the causes. There are so many unknowns in this dance. On today's episode, we're looking at human fertility and how science can assist nature. The field of reproductive medicine is still pretty new. The first baby conceived via in vitro fertilization, or IVF, was born in 1978, and new procedures and protocols are coming out all the time. When people have fertility issues today, they have options, but those options can take a big toll on you. I saw that up close with one of my good friends, Emily. She didn't want me to use her last name because this is all really personal, but she was willing to share her story. She and I met a long time before any of us talked about having kids or even serious partners. We would go out dancing or to dinner, that kind of thing. But then, slowly, almost everybody in that friend group got on the partner and baby train. Emily was 37 when she got married, and she was worried about her age. I had babies later in life without any issues, and I tried to reassure her. It's going to be fine. I joked that I was the patron saint of old ovaries. I was wrong. Emily and her husband started trying right away. After a few months, nothing happened, and she decided to get checked.
And they looked at a couple of hormones. And one of the hormones came back, which is called AMH, and it is an indicator of your egg reserve, how good your eggs are, how many eggs you have left. And that came back really low. Also, my thyroid was not good, which I hadn't known before. I had symptoms, but I guess I just blew them off.
The doctor started her on thyroid medications and made a recommendation, in vitro fertilization right away.
Which was shocking because IVF is like the Thunderdome of fertility treatments.
Emily's insurance actually paid for fertility treatments, which is rare. But first, she had to try a less invasive treatment called IUI, intrauterine insemination, where the sperm is placed directly into the uterus. And you also usually take drugs that stimulate ovulation. You're basically trying to give the sperm a head start. It was time-consuming, intense, at times somewhat comical.
My husband gave me the sample, and I put it into a sock and shoved that into my shirt and was driving through the city in rush hour traffic to get to the clinic on time so the sperm would be good.
So you were trying to keep it warm?
Yeah, to keep it warm. You don't.
So your husband had to produce the sperm, the sample. I like all these euphemisms. But so he had to produce the sample at home. Mm-hmm. And how did he feel about that? I mean, that's sort of also like...
Yeah, it's not sexy. It isn't fun. It isn't romantic. I didn't ask him a lot about that. I guess I didn't really want to know.
Emily got pregnant on the first try, but that pregnancy didn't work out. So she had to try this approach 3 more times. All 3 failed. Then her insurance company finally cleared her to move on to IVF, in vitro fertilization.
And that's way more intense, and you definitely have to schedule your life around it. I missed a memorial service for my grandfather. I almost missed a friend's wedding.
In the most basic terms, the process worked like this. Emily got a lot of different injections so that several of her eggs would mature all at once, as many as possible. All of this requires exact timing and perfect scheduling. Then she had to go to the clinic, go under anesthesia, and have those eggs retrieved.
So you might get 5, you might get 40.
The eggs were fertilized at the clinic.
And then you get these phone calls, which are exciting but kind of scary. So you get a call on the second day. This is how many fertilized. So we got 10 eggs. And you're like, wow, 10 eggs is great. Okay, 6 of them fertilized. So there's all this attrition along the way. And you're like, okay, so I have 6. So I've had 6 babies. That's a lot of babies. I'm doing pretty good.
But as each day passed, fewer were left. Then Emily opted to have the remaining embryos tested for genetic issues, which ups the chances for ultimate success. Because there were so few eggs, Emily went through this entire grueling retrieval process 3 times.
I ended up with 3 embryos out of 3 cycles.
When they transferred the first one into Emily's uterus, everybody at the clinic was hopeful.
So in the room, I went in, they show you a picture of your embryo on the screen, so you see it. You see them suck it up into a little catheter, and your husband or partner is in the room with you. And then they put it into your uterus, and they want to put it in the right spot, and your lining has to be perfect, and all the stars have to align. And up until then, they had had such good success rates that the nurses actually said congratulations, and people were kind of doing a congratulatory thing in the room. And I thought, oh, this is it. I'm pregnant, right? It's great. And I went home and like ate pineapple core and all the things they tell you to do and put your feet up or don't put your feet up, depending on all the Googling I had done and all the research I had done, and it didn't work. I was just like devastated.
Emily tried again with the second embryo. To help establish the pregnancy, she had to get injections of progesterone.
And they hurt. It's a huge needle. It's a 19-gauge needle. Bruises all over your backside. Someone has to do it for you. You can't do it yourself very easily. So one time my husband was out of town. I had to get a friend to do it, which is kind of weird. You ice up, you drink a glass of wine, pop that huge needle into your butt, and it bleeds. I would take a Sharpie and mark off sectors of my rear end that had veins or arteries in them that would bleed. Like, stay away from that part, you know?
The second transfer failed. Her doctor ran tests on Emily. She had developed a fibroid, a benign growth in her uterus, and also her thyroid levels were not well controlled. So she had to get this fibroid removed, which meant more surgery. After that, a break to recover.
And I was devastated. I had one more embryo left, and it was a boy, and I really wanted a girl, and we had used the 2 first girls and put them back into my uterus, and it had a fibroid probably. And so those were my daughters. In my mind, I am like devastated over this. And we had this one male embryo left. And I had a lot of resentment for this embryo.
When she felt really low, she would think awful things.
I'm gonna flush it down the toilet. I'm gonna squish it. I don't want this embryo. I just knew that I was gonna try this last one and it wasn't gonna work and it was gonna kill me. Because that meant that was the end of me having my own biological child.
Emily went on a little vacation to Florida. She didn't even want to go, but it helped change her outlook.
We came back and I suddenly got like very optimistic and I felt like this is going to work this time. And I don't know why I felt that way, but I just had this feeling like this is going to work.
Soon, it was time to have that last embryo implanted.
And it worked. And I think I was with you while I was pregnant but didn't know it yet. And when I found out, I took the test and it was such a faint line.
She kept taking more pregnancy tests, and each time the second line that indicates a positive was more visible.
I watched it get darker and darker and darker and darker and darker. And then I now have a almost 5-year-old little boy.
And he's beautiful.
And then, which I didn't think was going to happen, but now my thyroid is fixed and now I don't have fibroids. And when he was 1 year old, I got pregnant again without any intervention at all. And I have a little girl. I have a little girl who just turned 3. And it just feels like a miracle. Yeah.
I remember that. I was like, what?
You were the first person I told when I got pregnant with her. Because I'm like, this isn't going to work out. Because I'm 41. And there's no way that this is going to turn into a baby. But I just need to tell somebody about this.
Yeah. And here she is.
And they're upstairs watching Frozen or something.
As they do.
That's my friend Emily describing her long journey to get pregnant. We're talking about fertility and what scientists are learning about assisting nature. Many women are waiting longer to have babies, and after the age of 35, the quality and number of eggs declines pretty rapidly. But there's something else that could get in the way of having babies.
We've got a double whammy of events happening. It's what I call the perfect recipe or perfect storm for infertility.
That's Richard Sharp. He's been researching male fertility for almost 40 years. He's at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. He says over time, there's been a downward trend in sperm count observed in Western countries.
We're talking about a 50% fall. So something that is quite substantial, and that's happened over a period of 60 or 70 years, and we're still not sure of what has caused that fall. The aspect that puzzles a lot of people is that even after a 50% fall, most men are producing something around about 100 million sperm per day.
But you need a lot of sperm if you want just one to reach the egg.
It's a long journey within the female reproductive tract at the site of fertilization, and it's foreign territory. The semen that it, at ejaculation contains various factors that try to sort of hoodwink the female's immune system to give the sperm protection. But it is hostile territory, and it's the equivalent of what would be a 30 to 40 mile swim for you or me.
And humans are not great at making sperm. Most of it is not normal.
So we're almost unique amongst species that show that property, that we seem to have very, very poor semen quality. So bad that if we were a bull or something like this, we would certainly never be used at stud. We would be sent to the abattoir.
If a man has low sperm count, can that be, or slow sperm is another term we sometimes hear, is there something that can be done?
I'm ashamed to say that there's very little that we can offer to such men.
Of course, we hear all the time about different things that supposedly diminish men's sperm count. Tight jeans, tight underwear, hot baths, saunas. Richard says diet can have an impact, but
these are not things that we can say are going to transform you from a low sperm producer to a high sperm producer. But they may tip the balance. Those are the only sorts of things that we can offer simple advice.
And what do we know about the causes? Where does male infertility begin?
That is the big question to which we do not have a nice, neat answer, I'm afraid. The most likely origin of that is actually long before you ever make sperm. When the male fetus was growing in the mother's womb, and that development and function of the reproductive system wasn't optimal.
Does research lag behind in terms of male infertility? It seems like on the female infertility side, there have been several breakthroughs. There are better chances now. Is the research also slower?
Oh, absolutely. We're decades behind in terms of understanding the normal physiology of sperm production, let alone our understanding of when things go wrong. And I think it's because, you know, looking at male infertility is not very sexy.
Richard says a lot of the basic science on male fertility still has to be done. And also, the people who are most affected by this are often not comfortable talking about it.
Men are, we see that, you know, getting something wrong with you is a sort of a sign of weakness. And I think that reaches its peak when you come to talking about reproductive function. Mm. The idea that a man could be underperforming in any way, but particularly with regard to his fertility, is pretty undermining from a psychological point of view.
There have been some advancements to combat male infertility. You can basically find one good sperm, extract it, and then inject sperm directly into an egg. But that means eggs have to be harvested and then put back inside the uterus. Richard says this has allowed us to skip the problem of male infertility altogether.
It's a rather unique scenario in medicine that where you have the problem in the male, you're actually having to invasively treat the female partner. We've got a male problem, but it's put the spotlight on the female. And that's where all the research money has gone. And essentially, people have started to say, well, we don't even need to know what the problem is in the male. So you can see that's a sort of a vote for ignorance.
Richard Sharp researches male infertility at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about human fertility and what scientists are learning about assisting nature. People having trouble conceiving have options today, but these options have brought new challenges and issues. So now let's take a look at some of those. The earliest serious attempts to help nature along when pregnancy didn't happen naturally was artificial insemination. Infertility was a taboo topic for a long time, and certainly male infertility. But some doctors had a suspicion that maybe the sperm could be to blame in some situations, and they used donors. In the U.S., that started in the late 19th century. Sometimes women were told to keep it a secret, or sperm was mixed so that nobody would know. Reproductive medicine has become much less Wild West since then, but regulations have been slow compared to the pace of innovation. Liz White and her husband were having fertility issues in the 1980s. In Liz's case, the issue was her husband. His sperm was not viable. They were living in Indianapolis, and they decided to go for treatment. Liz's doctors were using frozen sperm, and it didn't work. After months and months, she was told to use another doctor. Lauren Bavis and Jake Harper explore what happened next in the podcast Sick.
So in 1981, Liz's doctor referred her to someone else, a well-known fertility specialist named Donald Klein. She was told he was the best of the best, and Klein's reputation had to do with one little room at his office.
And I remember the first visit, you come in the door, the waiting room is small, somewhat dark, and then there's an immediate hall to the left. And as you come into that hall, on the left side is a half bath, which we call the magazine room.
Klein didn't use a sperm bank. Frozen sperm had a lower success rate, so Liz would get sperm from a live donor. St. Vincent Hospital was across the street from Klein's office, and he said he would find a medical resident who looked like Liz's husband. And the way Liz understood it, when she came in for her appointments, that resident would go into the magazine room to provide a sperm sample.
In that first meeting, Liz was impressed with Klein's results. She looked at a corkboard next to her. It was covered with baby photos.
I remember the wall of pictures of the babies that he had produced.
So she started seeing Klein. Every month, during the brief time she was ovulating, Liz went to Klein's office 3 times for artificial insemination. Back then, the stigma of being infertile was much stronger. People just didn't talk about it.
So Liz invented excuses to leave work for her appointments. She kept her emotions to herself.
And she didn't talk to anyone about what she was going through. Not her friends, not her family, not even her husband.
I kept the privacy of having my period start and the sadness, really more to myself. I really carried that. And I didn't want him to feel any worse than he felt. So the disappointment I felt, I hid from him. He knew I was going, but it wasn't like a conversation where, oh, I'm sorry, you had your period again. I did it alone.
And looking back, Liz says Klein didn't really talk her through what was going on during her appointments.
I remember him being friendly at the first visit with my husband. After that, it was just a procedural kind of thing.
Transactional almost?
Yes. I don't remember a conversation with Klein being anything warm or engaging or comforting. So I could trust him more. I just remember it being procedural. I expected him to do what he was good at. I expected the truth from him and never thought he was lying to me.
After 5 months of treatment, 15 visits, Liz got pregnant.
Hey, Matt.
Hey.
That's Matt White, Liz's son. I first met him in a parking lot north of Indianapolis. Matt knew the basics of his parents' fertility issues. His parents told him when he asked about their blood types, part of an assignment in his high school biology class. It didn't change how he felt about his dad.
I just kept treating him and interacting with him just as if, you know, he was my biological father. It really didn't change anything.
Matt went off to college, studied birds in grad school, got married and had kids of his own. Then one day in 2016, he was at work, sitting at his desk, and he came across a news article about a local fertility doctor accused of lying to his patients.
I just quickly opened the article and I just started reading and I was just like, I'm going to be a part of this.
Matt's remembering this as we sit in his Honda near the building where he was conceived.
I think if I went in, I'd kind of probably get goosebumps. I'd start feeling really weird about this is where he was doing this in this room and then he was going over there where his patients were.
The he in that sentence is his mom's doctor. Donald Klein.
You know, when she came in, what did she think was going to happen? Like, walk me through what she thought the procedure was.
For what she was doing, you know, Klein sat down and said, okay, you know, I'll look for a donor that's 6 feet tall, you know, brown hair, brown eyes. The idea would be to go in, change into a robe, get on the chair, and he'll go and get the sample and they'll do the insemination.
But that didn't happen.
No.
What did he do instead?
He masturbated and collected his own sample and walked back in that room and put it in my mother. And that's how I was conceived.
If you want to find out what happened to Donald Klein, check out the first season of the podcast Sick. We'll put a link on our website. And joining me now to talk more about all of this are the co-hosts of this podcast, Lauren Bavis and Jake Harper. So how did all of this first come out?
Sure. So a lot of people who are conceived using donor sperm or eggs, a lot of them will try to find out more about their origins. And so one of the ways they can do that is go on to a donor sibling registry. You can actually connect to other donor conceived children, including people whose parents went to the same doctor as you. So that actually happened in this case. Four women whose parents had all gone to see Dr. Klein found each other through one of these websites, and together they decided to take a DNA test. And so when those results came back, they found out they were all siblings. They're all half siblings. And then not only that, they found out that there were four other ones. So there were eight total. And what Dr. Klein had told their parents was that he would only use a given donor for up to three successful pregnancies. And since there were eight of them, they immediately recognized something was off. And they actually suspected Klein had done this. And so they started doing more and more research into some of the other connections that they found through these DNA tests. And they figured out that they were, in fact, related to Klein.
And how many years did he practice? How many years did this go on for? How many kids did he father?
So Klein started practicing in Indianapolis in the early 70s and retired in 2009. But so far as we know, there's around 70 identified biological half-siblings, and that includes the children that Klein had with his wife. And right now, that's just the siblings that they know about. More people continue to be identified as they use these direct-to-consumer DNA tests like from 23andMe and Ancestry.com.
Now, there's obviously the horrible element of deception here and lying to patients, but is this a crime?
So the legal system is basically not prepared to deal with this situation in most states, and Indiana is an example of that. When this was happening, it was not a crime in Indiana. There was no state law, and there's still no federal law that makes it illegal for a doctor to use his own sperm to impregnate a patient. Last year, Indiana and Texas actually made it illegal for a doctor to do what Klein did. So that is a law moving forward, but it wouldn't retroactively apply to what Klein and other doctors have done. And it's something states will have to learn from, because this does keep popping up.
But if we talk about sperm banks, I mean, how much control do customers have in terms of how many samples a sperm donor has given? And even if the bank says we control that, the donor could still go to another sperm bank company, right? So how much control do people really have over this?
Part of the problem is that there's no requirement to track how many babies are born using sperm donors in the U.S. The CDC collects data on assisted reproductive technology, so things like IVF procedures and procedures that use donor eggs, but nothing about donor sperm. And clinics can have their own rules about how many times they might use a donor for a specific number of pregnancies, but there's no federal guidelines on that, nothing mandated. There is a pretty prominent example. Last season on The Bachelorette, there was a contestant who said that he had more than 100 kids via his sperm donation. So it's a problem that I think the siblings, the people who kind of this group that they're calling themselves of the biological half-children of Donald Klein, it's a concern that they have, because if they don't know how many biological half-siblings they have, they don't know how concerned they should be for potentially meeting those other half-siblings and forming relationships with them, maybe romantic relationships. Once they have children, those children are going to have really serious conversations getting to know the people that they're involved with. And that's going to be something that's going to have to happen for a couple of generations.
Yeah. What has been the general fallout in the community around this doctor? I'm sure people had different reactions.
Yeah. In talking to multiple siblings, the reactions vary. We spoke to one guy who found out he was related to Donald Klein, and he kind of, not that he wasn't upset, but he sees it as kind of, he's just DNA content is kind of what he said. Whereas other people who've had this experience of finding out, they go through an identity crisis. And so people have sort of a variety of reactions. But I do think it's fair to say that most of them are negative reactions, if not all of them. The other thing that I think comes up is a lot of the people that we spoke to compare this to rape. And I think it's one of those things that in hindsight, you're seeing that this doctor put his sperm inside of you as a patient or your mother and did it without her consent. And so the comparison, I think, makes sense to a lot of these siblings, and it's a hard thing to deal with, even though they're finding out so many years later.
That's Jake Harper and Lauren Bavis. They are the co-hosts of the podcast Sick, which is produced by Side Effects Public Media. That's a public radio collaboration focused on healthcare and is based at WFYI in Indianapolis. We're talking about infertility on The Pulse. Earlier on the episode, we heard from Emily, who used in vitro fertilization. Eggs are retrieved during a surgical procedure, then fertilized, and then eventually implanted into the uterus. Clinics usually try to create a surplus of embryos. They are frozen and stored to up the chances at success. But often, they are not needed. And that means that thousands and thousands of such embryos end up frozen in time. What to do with them? Liz Tung reports.
Jessica Ivry's been on the fence for a while now. It's a decision she tries not to think about, but every month she gets a reminder in the form of a bill.
$45 a month, and I just got a letter that it's going up to $50 a month.
For Jessica, every dollar counts. She's a single mom living in the Bay Area, which is super expensive. And to top it all off,
I'm a musician and a public music school teacher.
So Jessica's not exactly rolling in dough. And yet every month she pays a $45, soon to be $50 storage fee for a single frozen embryo, which for the past 4 years has resided at the clinic where Jessica went to get fertility treatments.
I think I'm still holding on to it because I just can't make a decision. I think that's what it is. I think it's more about my inability at this point to make a decision.
It's a significant issue. There are easily hundreds of thousands of embryos, if not more, around the United States that are frozen and waiting for some form of disposition.
That's Eric Widra. He's the medical director for a chain of fertility clinics called Shady Grove. And what he just said a second ago was disposition, as in embryo disposition, which is the official term for what people decide to do with their frozen embryos once they finish with IVF. It's a possibility patients are confronted with before they even start the process, in the form of a consent document that lays out four options for what to do with frozen embryos. One, keep them frozen in case you want more kids down the line. Two, donate them to scientific research. Three, donate them to another person or a couple trying to conceive. Or four, dispose of the embryo, which essentially involves taking it out of the freezer and letting it thaw. So those are the options. Pretty much something for everyone. Keep, dispose, or donate. But Eric says a lot of patients agonize over what to do with their remaining embryos.
They're torn because they feel a certain responsibility to these embryos. They've created them. They often went through sometimes years of pain and infertility in order to get to the point where they have children. But there's a spectrum of comfort among patients with discarding them or donating them. But I think everyone struggles a bit with how to think about these embryos.
Embryos are like the Rorschach test of the fertility world. Patients, doctors, even state laws see them as wildly different creatures with wildly different meanings. They can be tiny little lives or just bits of medical tissue. They could be considered property or, if pro-life activists have their way, an actual person. And all of that's just the baseline for how we as a culture think about embryos. It's ambiguous and messy. And it's even messier for the women and couples who have to decide what to do with them. One researcher who knows that better than most is Anne Lyerly. She's an OBGYN and bioethicist. She also teaches at the University of North Carolina's medical school. And around 2005-2006, she started interviewing fertility patients about what they were deciding to do with their frozen embryos, which at this point, surprisingly few researchers had done.
And those were really spectacular, eye-opening interviews, I have to say.
Anne says some people thought of the embryos as actual living beings. Other people thought of them as just raw biological material, but most people fell somewhere in between. But no matter where they landed, there's a feeling almost all of them shared.
Individuals felt like there was a significance to the embryo. And also for many of these individuals, there was a pretty large emotional and financial investment in them. So whatever they understood to be their responsibility and whatever they understood to be the moral status of the embryo, it had a value to them in their lives.
Which is why a lot of people felt like their options for disposition just weren't good enough, weren't respectful enough. So they came up with some of their own ideas for what a good disposal process would look like.
So one possibility women came up with was to have some kind of ceremony where they could have a quiet moment with their embryo, where they could say goodbye. The other thing that they came up with, and it was so interesting because we heard this more than once, was the idea of having the embryo put back in their body at a time that they would not be likely to get pregnant.
Anne says a lot of the women she talked to worried that people would find these ideas kind of weird, but she says they're representative of the enormous investment, financial, emotional, physical, that women go through with IVF. For Jessica Ivry, that process started in 2014. She had just hit 40, was single, and knew that she wanted kids. so she decided to try out IVF.
It's all consuming. There's no way. There's no way to just like carry on. Everything's fine. I mean, it's painful. Even thinking about it, it's painful.
Stories like Jessica's are really common. For women 40 and older, the chance of getting pregnant with just one round of IVF is only 8%, which means a lot of them end up going through multiple rounds, some as many as 8 or 9. And remember, each round is an involved, invasive, and expensive marathon, with an average cost of $12,000 per round. Anne Lyerly says the hope and desperation some women feel at the outset can make it really hard to contemplate the idea of having extra embryos when they're starting out.
What I would say is, like, when you're in the state of mind where you're thinking about wanting a baby and that every embryo is precious to you because it's possibly going to be that baby that you want, very few felt prepared to make that decision when they arrived at needing to make it.
This was Jessica's situation exactly. After months of being pumped full of hormones and medications, after spending thousands of dollars and countless hours in doctor's offices, her chances boiled down to 2 healthy embryos, one of which would be implanted and the other stored away. That first one,
Mommy,
it became her daughter.
I got chocolate, vanilla.
Her name's Esther. Jessica calls her Esty.
And what are you going to do with all of those things?
They're ice cream flavors.
The other embryo, the sole survivor of Jessica's 2 rounds of IVF, stayed in storage. But a funny thing happened after Jessica's daughter was born. She stopped thinking of the frozen embryo as just an embryo and started thinking of it as something more real.
It was so abstract then. Now I think of it like this is a full sibling to my daughter. And wouldn't it be amazing if I had another child because she could have a sibling?
It's something Jessica's been thinking about ever since her daughter was born, completing their little family with that one last embryo. But she says now that she's in her mid-40s, it's looking less and less likely that that embryo would be able to turn into a real live baby.
At this point, I really don't know how it could happen. It's really sad to me to think of having the fertility clinic discard the embryo. I would much rather donate it and have someone use it.
Jessica's actually tried to find couples to adopt her embryo, but so far, nothing's worked out. She says even after years of talking and thinking about it, of looking for solutions, she still has no idea what to do. So for now, she and her embryo will just continue to wait, both of them frozen in a kind of endless limbo.
That story was reported by Liz Tong. Coming up, we look at the strange disposable organ that makes pregnancy and birth possible.
It looks like it should be pulsating, and it looks like it landed here from another planet.
That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about human fertility. In the process of understanding what helps or hinders fertility, scientists have learned a lot about the complicated mechanics of this process. Our last story takes us back in time, way back. If you want to know why humans reproduce the way we do, where the baby grows on the inside until birth rather than hatching from an egg, you have to look at a disposable organ, the placenta. Regular Pulse contributor Avir Mitra, an emergency room physician, looked into its evolutionary history, and he enlisted the help of a friend, Kelsey Coulihan. Kelsey is a fourth-year medical student at Cooper Medical School in New Jersey. She became obsessed with placentas during her OBGYN rotation.
So I'm in the labor and delivery room, and I'm witnessing the whole miracle of birth thing, you know, whatever, whatever. The baby is born. It's amazing. Then I notice there's one lonely resident at the foot of the bed who's still, like, pulling something, like massaging something out of mom's uterus. He pulls it out. He inspects it really quick and then slaps it on the table, turns his back because he has more important things to deal with. But I didn't turn my back, and I could not stop looking at this thing and just wondering, like, what actually is that thing?
That thing was the placenta.
And it looks almost like if a pancake was made out of meat, and it's got this like purple hue to it, and it looks like it should be pulsating, and it looks like it landed here from another planet.
If you picture a baby in the womb, it's sitting in a thin sac filled with amniotic fluid. The sac is made by the baby, not the mom. One part of that sac thickens and basically attaches to the mother's womb. That thicker part is the placenta. For whatever reason, this placenta needed some further inspection in the pathology lab. Most people would have followed the baby, but Kelsey decided to follow the placenta.
I think something is just wrong with me.
That's where she met Dr. Barrueta.
My name is Julieta Barrueta. I'm a pathologist at Cooper University Hospital. I have a subspecialty in gynecological pathology, so part of my daily work is to look at placentas under the microscope.
Yeah, and that's where I started to realize the placenta was even more interesting than it looked.
Well, how so?
First of all, it's the only temporary organ. Second, it's a baby's lung, it's a waste disposal system, and it's a nutrition source. Like, that's amazing.
True. Okay.
And everyone thinks the umbilical cord connects baby and mom, but actually it connects baby and placenta. The placenta is in control.
In order for the placenta to do all this amazing stuff, it has to do something that no other tissue can do. Julieta explains it like this.
The placenta is a fascinating organ that allows for two human beings that are genetically very different, because half of the fetus is going to be maternal, but the other half is going to be paternal. And yet, a pregnancy can go on for 9 months without the mom's body destroying it. And that, from an immune standpoint, is fascinating, because if you were to receive a piece of someone else and have that inserted under your skin, that would not last there for 3 days. Your body will actively reject it.
So the placenta has to be the most incredible gatekeeper. It has to let oxygen and nutrients get to the baby. It has to let carbon dioxide and waste get out. Medicines can get through. Protective antibodies can get through. But if the mother and baby ever actually touched, or if any blood got through, the mother's immune system would immediately kill the baby.
So I went home and started researching, like, where did this thing come from?
She stumbled across a paper by Ed Chung, who researches molecular cellular developmental biology at the BioFrontiers Institute in Colorado.
So basically, the placenta, we kind of think of as a defining hallmark or characteristic of live-bearing mammals, primates, rodents, dogs, cats, etc.
It's estimated that it evolved around 150 to 200 million years ago.
So before that, what were we doing exactly?
Well, if you wanted to reproduce, you had to lay an egg.
So before placentas, a baby had to be in an eggshell, literally walled off from the mom.
All the nutrients baby needed had to already be in the egg from the get-go. If you think about a chicken egg, that's exactly what the yolk is. It's a care package that has to last the embryo until it's born.
The evolution of placenta essentially involved losing that eggshell and instead replacing that with some kind of tissue or organ that attaches to the mother's uterus during development.
But losing that shell presents some challenges.
At the same time, it's important that the maternal and fetal bloodstreams remain separate. And so the separation of these bloodstreams is established through this cell layer called the syncytial trophoblast.
The syncytial trophoblast is the outermost layer of the placenta, the part that's pressed against the mom's uterus. It's literally a layer of cells that have fused together, forming a wall.
This is where the magic happens. This wall of cells keeps mom and baby working in harmony and not killing each other. There's no other structure like this anywhere else in the body.
When evolutionary biologists like Ed Chung mapped the genomes of these cells, they found something very odd.
So the protein that allowed these cells to fuse into a wall, it's called syncytin, it didn't look like it came from human DNA.
Well, what did it look like?
It looked more like, drumroll please, HIV.
What?
Yeah. What Ed Chung told me is that this protein actually came from an ancient retrovirus, quite similar to HIV.
So you're saying our placentas are made, at least kind of, partially made from viral DNA?
Exactly.
Let's take a step back. Viruses are little strips of biologic information that can't do anything on their own. So they enter cells and hijack the cell's machinery to make copies of themselves and replicate and move on to infect other cells. Retroviruses take it to the next level because they are strips of DNA that enter cells and just go ahead and insert themselves into the host's own DNA. Now the host is stuck with viral DNA for the rest of its life, and it can never stop doing what the virus wants.
You know, today we have the most famous retrovirus is, of course, HIV. But retroviruses like HIV have been infecting vertebrates for probably a couple hundred million years.
So the consensus among evolutionary biologists is that once upon a time, some retrovirus infected an egg-laying vertebrate, and by chance, that virus settled into that animal's egg cells.
And it just so happened that that particular infected egg met a nice sperm and got fertilized.
The baby that was hatched, whatever kind of proto-mammal it was, now had copies of that virus's DNA in all of its cells.
Right, because if the retrovirus managed to insert itself into the first cell, it would be copied into every subsequent cell.
Yep.
The virus didn't kill the baby. If it had, we wouldn't be sitting here as humans telling the story. What it did do was give this offspring a premium feature.
So we got an upgrade, like viral status. Viruses fuse with things in order to infect them, right? So now we get this viral DNA that lets us make a protein that fuses things.
This once viral protein essentially slowly morphed or evolved into what we now know as syncytin.
So back to the proto-mammal. It contains viral DNA that codes for this syncytin protein. This protein gives the baby the ability to fuse cells into a wall. A wall that connects mom and baby but also keeps them separate.
It gives this baby the ability to create a placenta.
Basically, this virus helped that mammalian ancestor survive better by giving it a better placenta, then this piece of DNA would have been passed on to the generation and eventually spread into the population. And in this process is essentially what we think of as a molecular domestication of an ancient retrovirus.
Wow. So the virus tried to hijack us, but we hijacked it.
Yes. But it's worth noting that this probably didn't happen overnight. This was the key step, but it probably took many more generations worth of mutations.
But still, I mean, talk about turning lemons into lemonade. And it's not just placentas. Biologists have found huge chunks of our DNA that are actually remnants of ancient viral infections. Looks like we've been domesticating viruses for a long time. Or have the viruses been domesticating us? Either way, what all that DNA is doing for us, for the most part, is still a mystery.
It just seems like, in a way, we're part virus. Otherwise, we'd be laying eggs.
Exactly. I think that is the key takeaway.
That story was reported by Avir Mitra. He's an emergency room physician in New York City and a regular Pulse contributor. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. Our intern is Sabrina Ems. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.